Hello. Welcome to Byzantine Dreams with Michael and Carolyn.
In this episode, we speak with our friend and colleague, Jameson Locke. Jameson is one of the most well-known cypherpunks, OG Bitcoiners, and thought leaders in the realms of privacy, personal sovereignty, self-defense, and other related topics working today.
So we wanted to speak with Jameson for our first episode for three reasons. First, because of his deep history with the Bitcoin project. Many out there know him from his role in Bitcoin governance, namely the SegWit debates and split of 2016. And the second reason is because his strong individual autonomy and anti-censorship perspective is a very crucial one to question and explore during the deep social unrest that permeates 2020, in our opinion. And lastly, so few people know this about Jameson, but we wanted to highlight his affinity for the promise of technology above all else. Jameson is a wonderfully imaginative and optimistic futurist. He believes in the singularity, the promise of human space travel and colonization, the ability to upload your consciousness someday, all that fun stuff. And, you know, I suppose he only naturally has these inclinations since he's somebody that was so important to bringing Bitcoin as we know it into existence. But we wanted to highlight that creativity and hopefulness he certainly possesses, but maybe you so rarely hear play out on crypto Twitter, which leans towards the angry and provocative rather than hopeful.
Yes, speaking of which, so one note for our listeners, we touch several times, actually quite a bit during this episode, on Jameson's advocacy for gun ownership and his stance on self-defense. Those of you that don't know Jameson may find this surprising. We thought it'd be prudent to give you a little bit of background on this. So in 2017, Jameson was the victim of a swatting attack. For those of you who don't know, swatting is a harassment tactic where an attacker calls into local emergency services, so 911, reporting a serious law enforcement emergency, like a bomb threat, a mental health emergency, a hostage situation, etc., which hoaxes the law enforcement into dispatching emergency response services to that victim's house. So in Jameson's case, the attacker was a disgruntled Bitcoiner who had gotten a hold of Jameson's personal address online, and they called in a hostage situation. This dispatched a SWAT team to Jameson's house. Jameson was actually away at the time, but his family was home. Thankfully, he was safe. His family was safe. Nothing came of this. But people die this way every year. So note that Jameson's affinity for firearms predates this event, but it was certainly sharpened by it. His views are, not necessarily ones that Carolyn and I are 100% aligned with, but they're incredibly well-reasoned and internally consistent and important. Interestingly, with the swatting event, Jameson does not blame the attacker, but actually the incentive structures around swatting that he believes enable and encourage this kind of behavior.
So that's the context for this episode. Now you know. And without further ado, here is the first episode of Byzantine Dreams with Jameson Locke. Hi there. Welcome to Byzantine Dreams. This is Carolyn Rackow.
And I'm Michael Haley.
And today we are joined with a great friend of ours, the cypherpunk Jameson Lopp.
Hello.
Awesome. So Jameson is the CTO and co-founder of Casa, and also a colleague of mine.
And a former colleague of mine. We actually all used to work together at Casa. Yeah. I'm thinking back to some retreats back in the day when the team was smaller. And actually, I think I shot my first gun with Jameson at a Casa retreat, which was quite an experience. I'm glad I had that one.
It was a tragic shooting accident, but I'm glad the team bonding was strong. So, all right, well, let's just jump right in here. So, Jameson,
The other weekend on Twitter, you were unpacking a acronym that's been prevalent on the Twitter waves, which is ACAB or ACAB. We want to use this as a piece of yarn that we can tug on to get it a much bigger sweater. Can you describe what that acronym is and what it means and why it's been circulating recently?
Well, it means different things to different people, of course. In general, a lot of people are using it just to show their distaste or distrust or hatred of law enforcement by saying that all cops are bastards. But I think that it does go a lot deeper than just hating cops or hating some of the bad things that they have done or have been caught doing recently and, you know, over pretty much the entire history of policing. You know, this fundamentally goes back to the creation of, you know, public police forces, which at least in America, I think happened over 100 years ago at this point. But really what people are saying is that in order to participate in this organization, which is an enforcement organization, you can argue about whether it's good or bad, but if you're going to be an enforcer, whether it's for a public organization or for a private organization, like, you know, the mafia or organized crime or whatever, all of these organizations have enforcers, and they essentially are the ones that are doing the dirty work. They are the real embodiment of that organization's propensity to use violence to further its own goals. And it's, you know, it becomes more complicated when we're talking about nation state law enforcement, you know, government backed law enforcement, because, you know, they have this additional claim that everything that they're doing is for the good of their own citizens. But we have to realize that the primary goal is to maintain law and order. And the law, of course, means whatever the rules that the government and the politicians have decided are the best ones to set forward. And that doesn't necessarily mean that those rules are the ones that are the best for all of the citizens.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a core gesture in, you know, Kant's writing that the, you know, the evil of doing violence or doing evil can never be greater than the violence of declaring that some things are evil and some things are not. I mean, could you talk a little bit, you know, real, real high level here, Jameson, just on your views on like policing and kind of the state generally? I mean, you hinted at it before, but maybe we could talk a little bit about the state's monopoly on violence kind of writ large.
Right. I mean, one of the most important things to maintaining order, whatever that is basically being the final say. You know, you have to have the ability to turn your words or whatever it is that you dictate is good or allowed or lawful and turn that into the physical. And that means you need to have, you know, someone physically going out there and finding the people that are not obeying the words and somehow convincing them that they need to follow whatever you are saying. And of course, at the end of the day, you can't just have a polite argument with the vast majority of people and assume that you're going to convince them of whatever you're saying. At the end of the day, it has to come down to, physical intimidation, coercion, or otherwise taking physical control of someone's body so that they are no longer capable of undertaking whatever actions it is that you're disapproving of.
Yeah, I think it's been really jarring for a lot of people to be faced with the reality of what policing is, of what the downsides and the tragedies of living in a state. Could you, if you were to describe that power dynamic very, very succinctly in terms of what is the state and why does it need to have a monopoly on violence?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thesis, you know, what a lot of these ideas are really built upon is that it is the logic of violence that fundamentally shapes society as we know it. Mm-hmm. And what that really means when we say the logic of violence, we mean like what does violence get you? And the fact that it is easier to destroy things than it is to create things. And so the result of this is that power generally means the power to destroy rather than the power to create. And so the entities and organizations that form around power that end up being the most powerful are the ones that are capable and willing to use violence. And, you know, there's a pretty good argument to be made that, you know, what you see on the small scale with things like organized crime and, you know, protection rackets, that is just a small nation state. Essentially, organized crime is a like derogatory term that the larger, more powerful organized crime ring that calls itself the government and the nation state uses as a, you know, pejorative towards the smaller organizations that aspire to have a monopoly on violence, but they only really have, you know, a small amount of power and control. And you know, you can go back, you know, through all of human history and see how the logic of violence has unfolded over millennia. It has generally remained the same, but technology has changed it to the extent that the power of weapons and the power of, you know, organized entities to, you know, have even greater concentrated control and be able to extend the range of their violence is essentially resulted in consolidation, such that, you know, in the very, very early days, we were just talking about little tribes, you know, going around, you know, the extent of their power would be limited basically to horseback type like ranges. And these days, you know, the most powerful nation states have intercontinental ballistic missiles, and we're now talking about, you know, mutually assured destruction type scenarios.
Well, that's great. That's a very clear definition. I always love the historical POV. And so you mentioned, speaking of historical, you know, the size of the types of, you know, property and spaces that, you know, people are using violence to protect has changed. You know, technology has changed, and that means that weapons have changed. You're somebody that is definitely a proponent of, you know, the freedom to, you know, own a gun if you so choose. I'd be curious to hear a little bit more about your philosophy around gun ownership and also how you think about other sorts of weapons or technology that has changed throughout history in the context of this monopoly of violence dynamic.
Yeah, I mean, there's multiple aspects to it. One is just the fundamental belief that every human has the right to defend themselves against aggressors. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people get hung up on the whole firearm thing because that just happens to be the currently most accessible to individuals type of weapon. And, you know, it has proliferated throughout America to the point that I think we have more firearms than citizens. Wow. At this point. But, you know, I look beyond that. You know, I believe there's no moral reason why someone, if they have the ability and interest to do so, should not be able to own, say, a rocket launcher or a tank or a large naval vessel. It's actually not outside the historical purview for private citizens to own flotillas of armed vessels. I mean, you know, back in the like 1700s, 1800s, a lot of both fleets of pirates and fleets of anti-pirates, you know, pirate hunters were owned by private individuals. You know, they were not nation state owned. And yes, I mean, you have to be on the wealthier side to be able to own, you know, and control that level of resources. But, you know, I think that there's the fundamental reason that if you at least want to use your resources in defense, then you should be able to do so. You shouldn't have to worry about some larger entity claiming a monopoly on violence preventing you from doing that. But then from a different perspective, what do we really want the power dynamics to be? If we have one entity that is controlling a large amount of power, a large amount of land, resources, etc., and all of the people who are living in the territory claimed by that entity have no way to defend themselves other than like primitive, you know, rocks and sticks type of you know, protest movement, throwing them, you know, at armored soldiers and law enforcers and just having them bounce off, then you, what kind of society is that? You know, there's some fair quotes around this, like the government should fear its people rather than the people fearing its government. And it's about power dynamics. At least if we want to claim that we don't live in a dictatorship or a authoritarian society, if we want to claim that people have the freedom and the ability to fight back against government overreach and tyrannical government, then the people need to have, you know, some level of armaments. And you can argue about whether or not small arms is sufficient. I believe it is. I believe there's a lot of historical examples of guerrilla fighter movements that even the most sophisticated military technology wielded by the United States has not been able to quash. And if we're going to be able to have any sense of the government even somewhat fearing its citizens, then the citizens need a way to fight back in that situation.
Yeah. Well, as we all know, you know, certain forms of cryptography in this country were deemed, you know, munitions. And yeah, you know, I think it's actually a really interesting time to also tag that the individualist reading of the Second Amendment, right? The Second Amendment is pertaining primarily to the right of individuals to bear arms rather than militias. You could argue that that was really forwarded to a large extent by the Black Panther Party in Oakland, California, where I grew up.
Absolutely.
Yeah, tell us that story, Michael.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, for much of the history of this country, the Second Amendment was not the topic of discussion that it's been for the last 50 years or so. It was kind of this red-haired stepchild of the Bill of Rights. The Black Panthers, specifically Huey Newton, who was a law student at the time, he's working with Bobby Seale to help create the Black Panther Party, was really concerned about police brutality and police violence, and put two and two together when he was in a constitutional law class and thinking about how they would effectively curtail abuse of power by the police in West Oakland. And, you know, he and other members of the party got shotguns and started monitoring the police. And I'll include some show notes for people who want to read more and learn more about this, but it's really interesting. This propelled a pushback at, you know, the state level and kind of even outside of that with, you know, maybe not draconian gun laws, but definitely more restrictive gun laws throughout the country. And that's kind of what sparked the creation of the modern NRA as we know it. And the current, again, more individualist reading of the Second Amendment. You kind of wonder if, you know, this was, you know, happened 10 or 20 years later if the Panthers would have had, you know, PGP. Hmm. That would have been the that would have been sort of the domain of the standoff. I mean, the other thing that's been top of mind for us, Jameson, is, you know, with everything that's happened with coronavirus, the extent of the disruption that bioweapons could cause to day-to-day life has, I think, really started to sink in and become real for me, and I think probably real for a lot of our listeners. Could you talk a little bit about how this changes the payoff structure of violence?
Well, there is a big question, I think, about payoff. It definitely changes the requirements for creating a weapon of mass destruction. Why would anyone want to do that? I doubt that you could find a profitable way to do that, but you can certainly control a lot of people and, you know, make them afraid and make them change their day-to-day lives as a result. But essentially, you know, what technology does is it makes things cheaper. And what we've seen is that the resources required to create things, in this case, create destructive things, have continued to decrease. So you no longer need to have a multi-million dollar lab, for example, to be able to play around with organisms at the cellular level and essentially, you know, engineer different DNA and, you know, replicate it and, you know, see how it interacts with other biological organisms. Similar thing happening with firearms, for example. It's always been possible to create your own firearms, but before 10 years ago, you needed to have machining skills. You needed to have some reasonably heavy equipment that, you know, individuals could still acquire, but required much higher level amount of skill and time to go into building a firearm. And now you can, you know, literally download a file and calibrate a $200 machine that gets shipped to your house and put some plastic filament into it. And a day or so later, you've got a lower part of a handgun or AR-15 that you can use part kits and other completely unregulated materials to build a fully functioning firearm.
Yeah, so you're like wet lab style 3D printing. Wild.
How does Bitcoin fit in here? That's obviously, Jameson, where you spend, you know, pretty much all your professional energy these days. What in your mind can Bitcoin be beyond what it is today?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what can it become?
So everything that we've talked about so far has been about the capability for individuals and other entities to destroy. The interesting thing about Bitcoin and cryptography in general is that it creates a propensity and ability for people to protect. And what we're really talking about is protecting data. It allows you to use math to take any sensitive piece of data that you don't want anyone who is unauthorized to be able to access and essentially wrap it up in a digital safe that is impossible to crack without the right key. You know, even, you know, nation state level resources and, you know, all the NSA's servers combined can't crack into a well-designed cryptographically secured piece of data. So the question is, if that's like the fundamental building block that we have to start building safety as opposed to destruction, you know, what can we build with that building block? And we had during the 90s the crypto wars where, like you referred to, government was still considering cryptography a munition, something that was only really supposed to be used by military for military secrets, et cetera, et cetera. And we saw cypherpunk movements start to rise up as people were thinking through, you know, what can we do with these building blocks? How do we build anonymous systems so that people can communicate freely without having to worry about government or corporate prying, without having to worry about potential consequences of secrets being made public? And you know, one of the many things that was worked on in those early days was, you know, how do we use this fundamental building block to build a new financial system that is, you know, more secure and not reliant upon all of these choke points and third party actors that are controlling things. And there were quite a few attempts at that until eventually Bitcoin came around. And now we have this system that has been running for, let's see, 11 years now and withstood a variety of attacks. It has shown itself to be a robust, resilient financial network. Now, it's far from perfect. There's still a lot of work to be done, but unlike, you know, traditional financial system that is built for maximum efficiency and liquidity and whatnot, this one is built for maximum robustness. So we're seeing a, you know, completely different type of system rise up, and we're still really trying to figure out what we can do with it. There's, you know, a lot of very technically minded and creative people that are continuing to, you know, come up with new use cases and continuing to experiment with the possibilities that a system like this can really afford for us. But, you know, it ultimately it is about building a system where people can take control of their finances. And perhaps over the long term, the architecture of a system like this can be used as a model for other types of systems that are also architected with the fundamental goal being robustness and security and giving power to the individual user, rather than what we've seen with all the other systems that are, oh, we're going to give maximum efficiency and utility to as many people as possible, but we're going to do that by having one single entity controlling everything, and we're just going to hope that they play nice.
Before I started working at Casa, I read an essay you wrote called Notes on a Swatting. I wanted to quickly read two sentences from that and then ask you a follow-up question. So, while I certainly blame the attacker for the actions they took, my root cause analysis places the blame squarely upon law enforcement for creating an exploitable vulnerability. The militarization of police, combined with non-existent authentication, creates a great environment for swatting. So, what I want to ask here is, are there lessons about the transparency or the design of incentives in Bitcoin that the outside world can learn from?
I think so, though they are probably not directly obvious to most people. I mean, I think the good example of the swatting cases and the vulnerability there is that is all a result of fragile systems that have continued to have more things, more layers, you know, built on top of them. So, for example, the problem here with what I was referring to, like lack of authentication, is that, you know, the original phone system was very simple. You know, every phone number was a landline, and it was fairly simple to trace where a phone call came from because there were physical wires going somewhere. Now, fast forward 50, 100 years, And we have these additional layers that are built on top of the phone system, actually like internet interfaces and proxies that can allow someone to interface with the phone system through so many layers of abstraction at a software and hardware level that law enforcement isn't even able to trace where the call is necessarily coming from. And law enforcement has not adapted to that. I mean, there are a million different things that you could do to, you know, require stronger authentication on these calls, but they just haven't gotten to that point yet. So, you know, how do we look at Bitcoin and say, you know, we can learn lessons from this? Well, I think it's once again, it's about building for resilience and robustness and, you know, building from a defensive standpoint rather than a just, can I make it work? And then we'll just keep building other stuff on top of it and not worrying about potential negative consequences down the line.
Yeah. I've got one more question, you know, squarely on Bitcoin and what it can be. So, you know, I think one of the things that you're really well known for is you're a largely respected leader in the Bitcoin space. And I know you can say that there are no leaders in Bitcoin, only code, but I think few people would argue with me on that one. So I'm curious to hear your take on, like, what do you think the next SegWit style change will be in Bitcoin?
So, and we didn't really get too much into, I guess, the governance of Bitcoin, but the easiest way to explain it is that there is no governance. You know, it is crypto anarchy. It is an inversion of power such that instead of having a command and control, you know, hierarchical top-down type of system, instead it's this like bottom-up, like bubbling from each individual into forming a sort of organic result of the consensus for whatever Bitcoin should be. So the result of that is that it's harder to describe. It's almost impossible to define. Rather, we end up observing it. And, you know, as arguments happen, we try to, you know, aggregate, you know, what the general sentiments are across the various participants in the ecosystem. And we're constantly searching for signals, right? There's in a lot of systems of governance and bureaucracy or whatever, it's very simple. Like you take a vote and that's your signal. But in a system like this, where there is no like registration of identity, you have to worry about things like Sybil attacks, people, you know, essentially create cloning many versions of themselves digitally and trying to push sentiment in one way or another with sock puppets and other social media type of attacks, it's harder to find signal. And that can be very frustrating for people. And that's what results in some people eventually getting tired of using voice and they end up using the exit option, which is one of the primary, I think, the values of these systems, which you're not going to really find in traditional governance, because usually exit means like civil war or, you know, something terrible. But on the internet, if you want to exit, then you just click a button and now, you know, you go off and you create your own network. And there are certainly ramifications, but you don't have to worry about fighting with people anymore because you essentially just stop talking. So what can we learn from all of this? Where is it all going? It's hard to predict where it's going, what is going to become the next big point of contention. But, you know, what happened with the scaling debate and SegWit, et cetera, that was all due to a single point of contention around, should Bitcoin optimize for low transaction fees or should Bitcoin optimize for low cost of auditing the entire system. And it was the latter that eventually won out. And so I think the real question is there another one of these points of, you know, what should Bitcoin optimize for that mm-hmm. will be as contentious? And, you know, one of the big candidates is privacy. Should we make changes to Bitcoin that will improve privacy? And then what is the trade-off to that? There are a lot of interesting privacy technologies that have been developed. Most of them seem to be rejected by the Bitcoin ethos, either because they add too much complexity or, you know, require, once again, too much data, too much cost, computing cost, increasing the cost of verifying the system. Or in some cases with like more exotic cryptography, like zero-knowledge proofs, mm-hmm. they conflict with another major ethos of Bitcoin, which is the ability to audit the entire money supply. Hmm. So I wrote a blog post, I think, back at the beginning of the year, where I was trying to list as many of the like major ethos points of Bitcoin as possible. And I think there's at least a dozen or so. But, you know, some of them are technical, some of them are philosophical, some of them are economic. And that's why this system is so hard to predict, and why it's so hard to say what the next major conflict will be over, because there are so many different perspectives that are coming together to form this thing that we call Bitcoin. And it's multifaceted, multivariable, trying to figure out, you know, what are the next two big things that are going to run into conflict with each other and blow up. Mm-hmm. I think sociologists and anthropologists will have a lot of fun digging through the Bitcoin history.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it feels like Bitcoin is something that's still being gradually discovered as opposed to invented.
Yeah. Definitely.
I think at this point, this might be the right juncture to start looking at slightly more far-flung futuristic scenarios and, you know, what Bitcoin looks like if you put it in that sort of snow globe. So, man, Jameson, like, apart from Bitcoin or even VR, because I think cat's out of the bag now that you're kind of the VR guy, what's some of the more like futuristic tech that you're excited about seeing over the next, I don't know, 40 years?
Well, over 40 years, I'm really hopeful that we will see greater life extension technology. You know, just want to get to the singularity. I don't want to miss out on the singularity. You know, definitely hoping Ray, was it Kurzweil?
Kurzweil, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Ray Kurzweil is correct about, you know, 2050. But the crazy thing about all of this is, you know, exponential acceleration of technology makes some really far-fetched ideas actually be plausible even within our own lifetime. I'm certainly interested in seeing, you know, space technology continue to progress after being dormant for so long. You know, it was basically a nation-state dick-measuring contest for a number of decades there, but we're finally getting to like real commercialization of space and actually seeing innovation happen that I think may result in more meaningful progress, you know, getting humans to be a multiplanetary and hopefully eventually like multi-solar race is the only way that we are going to have sufficient redundancy against edge case astrophysical events that could completely wipe us out, or of course us wiping each other out. But ultimately, you know, what I want to see is the ability to apply these same types of technologies to safeguard myself and my consciousness. And the only way that I can really see someone being able to become a sovereign individual in the purest sense of the word would be to be able to digitize yourself so that you could then protect yourself with these same type of cryptographic mechanisms and ability to essentially back yourself up into, you know, multiple redundant geographic places that are no longer under single control of one entity or another.
Yeah. Well, so I have a question about this, Jameson. So if I were to make a digital copy of myself, here's what I'm not clear on is if the, and it's like a really basic transhumanist question, but I've never been able to get past it, is if I, you know, we take like, if we make a digital backup of, you know, my gray matter, it's unclear that my consciousness is going to find itself in that new substrate, right? And like, okay, if I make a bunch of digital backups of myself, but I die, do I even know that those backups are going on? It's this like consciousness awareness transfers question that's always been sticky for me.
I mean, it's certainly a mind blowing thing to think about, but you know, we have no evidence, I think, to show otherwise that, you know, if you make a copy of yourself, the copy is not every bit the same as you. It's kind of like what is the human body? You know, do we want to take this thing down to the like biological mechanics level of, you know, humans are a machine. We're an automaton that accepts inputs and creates outputs. And it just so happens that our central processing unit is currently beyond our capability to fully understand. But I do believe that, you know, it is something that will eventually be fully understood. And perhaps once we fully understand how the brain works and can make copies of it, be they biological copies or digital copies, and then observe that all of these copies act the exact same, you know, perhaps then it will become more clear exactly, you know, what consciousness really is.
Hmm. You had an interesting anecdote once, Jameson, about, you know, thinking about brain wallets and, you know, like cryogenics and some of these interesting like consciousness questions. I think that'd be a good one to repeat for our audience.
Yeah, this is like the Athens Bitcoin meetup that you're talking about, Jameson, with the like, okay, what's the incentive for someone to like unthaw you?
Yeah. Well, this is a problem that I don't believe has been fully solved, but there is an interesting question that comes down to like, if you believe that like the Alcor style freezing of your head in order to resuscitate you and, you know, hopefully bring you back to life and fix whatever problems that killed you in the first place. If that's like an actual feasible thing, then how do you ensure that you actually get resuscitated? How do you ensure that if that company needs to dedicate resources for hundreds of years to keep your head preserved so that it can be, you know, analyzed and reconstituted and whatever, how do you incentivize them to actually do that? Well, I mean, I guess you could like put money in a trust and, you know, dictate that the organization of that trust and the people who are fiduciaries and responsible for managing the trust's assets continue to be prudent in how they use them so that they can continue paying the preservation company on a regular basis. But I think that ignores, you know, some potential macro failures that could occur. So what if instead you could create some sort of bounty and essentially, you know, prove that you have the ability to access funds, but the only way that those funds are going to get accessed are, you know, if you're resuscitated. the main reason I think that this is a hard problem to solve is that we have to assume that any technology that is sufficiently capable of, you know, scanning your brain, bringing you back to life is probably also capable of extracting any secrets that you're keeping in your brain. Mm. So I think it would have to be a multi-piece type of setup that, you know, perhaps you have some instructions that you keep in your brain, but it, you know, it can't just be, you know, a single private key to a Bitcoin address, for example.
That's an interesting, you know, Bitcoin enabling, like, future transhumanist kind of vision. But I'm curious, do you think there are other ways that Bitcoin can aid in some of these far future tech scenarios?
I mean, AI is another important one.
I think that combining the ability for machines to essentially own money that, you know, the machines truly own the money and can control it without having to worry, of course, about third parties, gives rise to, you know, the idea of the DAO, the autonomous corporation, the ability to create an entire, like, operational infrastructure that basically is, like, self-sustaining is very interesting to me. I think one idea or one simple example of this, for example, that combines multiple early stage technologies of what we're seeing today would be, let's say I want to own a taxi company, but not just a traditional taxi company. I want to own a much more efficient taxi company that doesn't have to rely on humans at all. Rather, my taxi company is just a piece of software that is managing a fleet of self-driving cars that have, you know, full capability to diagnose themselves and report back on their status and take directives from me to, you know, pick up fares and drop them off, et cetera, et cetera. And by me, of course, I mean the software that I write to run the distributed organization. And, you know, these taxis would, of course, be accepting cryptocurrency that would go into the coffers of the DAO. And as the taxis needed to sustain themselves, you know, via, like, recharging or going to a mechanic to get repaired for various things, then the DAO would disperse the funds to whatever other entities it needed to interact with economically. And so on and so on. And, you know, perhaps you could even build more complex business logic in to, you know, determine when it was time to increase your capability of servicing more fares and, you know, purchase more cars and, you know, engage in other types of economic interaction. And there's really no reason why all of these things can't be run by algorithms. I'm sure you would still need to tweak the algorithms from time to time. Though, of course, if we really want to start talking about artificial intelligence, then perhaps the algorithms can learn from their own mistakes and tweak themselves. And I think this is where we really start getting towards some of the singularity type concepts of, you know, what happens when we get to the point that the vast majority of these complex organizations that currently comprise our society and in many cases require enormous amounts of human effort to keep, you know, maintained and running on a regular basis. What happens when they all get replaced by software? There's some, you know, utopian ideas that means it will become a post-work society, a post-scarcity society, and perhaps we'll all the humans will be able to just spend their time doing creative, self-fulfilling endeavors rather than having to worry about, you know, the lower tiers of, what is it, Maslow's
hierarchy of needs.
The pyramid, yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's, I think, sort of like Oscar Wilde's ideal. He has an essay about the soul of man in the age of socialism. And, you know, this was, you know, the 19th century. the machines would come in, they'd take care of the dirty work, and humans would, you know, paint in watercolor and, you know, make sculptures and, you know, sing songs.
Mm. So that's the fully automated space communism kind of dream.
Yeah. Well, I guess kind of starting to, I think, point towards a wrap up here. I mean, for all these different types of, I don't know, let's just say like singularity related tech that we're talking about, is there a central theme to what these are doing with respect to the dynamics of offense and defense that we were talking about earlier?
Yeah, I mean, in general, you know, what we're seeing is that the propensity for violence, the ability for an organization to exert control over others is decreasing, or at least the resources required for individuals to amplify their power and to amplify their defensive capabilities is becoming more affordable as a result of these technologies. I think of it in terms of leverage. At least as a software engineer, I could spend my time doing, you know, manual tasks and having to repeat them over and over again, or I can spend my time writing a bit of code and then have that code proliferate all around the internet and, you know, potentially get run thousands and millions of times, and I only have to write it once. And that's like the type of leverage that I think we generally see in technology, is the ability to use a little bit of human creativity and then magnify and amplify it using the technology. So what is the result, you know, when it comes to like individuals versus nation states versus, you know, other types of organizations that are based upon the ability to physically control things? I think it means that we start to level the playing field more. I think it means that people will have more leverage to essentially negotiate with these other entities that are primarily based upon violence. That, you know, government and nation states will turn less into a thing where we are treated like subjects and more into a relationship where we are treated like customers. So, you know, less the like involuntary taxation and more of like the I'm paying you fees for protection and these other socialized services. That's kind of like the long-term progression that I think we're seeing, but it's still fairly early days. I think at the moment, the only people who have really attained that level of like sovereign individual status are currently billionaires. You know, the capitalists who are at the head of companies that are so large and so wealthy that they are on par with nation states in many regards, and as a result have the ability, they have the leverage to negotiate with nation states for more favorable tax status, for example, for more favorable regulations. You know, that is currently available to a small set of people and entities, and I think that it will become more and more available as you know, technology continues to progress.
All right. Well, do you have to ask this last question? In when we're flying around in, you know, server farms in outer space, are sovereign individuals still going to be strapped? Are we still going to have guns?
We are certainly going to have some sort of, you know, offensive capabilities, you know. How will that manifest itself in the digital realm? That is an interesting question. We're going to need to have much better filters. And essentially, I think this is one of the more interesting aspects of artificial intelligence that I am interested in, which is, I mean, it's a glorified personal assistant, but you know, if we want to build a society that is more like a crypto anarchy, cyberpunk, futuristic, individualist society, then we need to build tools that enable us to, on an individual level, replace a lot of the services that nation states and governments provide to us. And through that, I mean, you know, basically various social services, whether it's, you know, your protection service, your health service, your insurance, et cetera, you know, these are all operations that the bureaucracy of government is essentially contracting out to other providers. Sometimes it's public workers, sometimes it's private contractors. You know, the roads aren't generally built by government employees. They're built by private contractors that, you know, they negotiate contracts with governments. And so essentially what I'm getting to is that if you want to replace all of that, you need the ability for each individual to enter into and negotiate and select from contracts for every one of those services that they need. You know, if you want to have truly free markets of all of these things, then that's going to overwhelm the average individual to have to go through that. There's a lot of overhead. But if you can build these artificial intelligence personal assistants that essentially know who you are and what decisions you would make, then you can start offloading a lot of that mental overhead onto software that essentially acts as an autonomous agent on your behalf. And I think can help replace a lot of the overhead that is currently performed by these bureaucratic institutions.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I know some folks who are thinking about a similar type of like cognitive overhead that they see in the future, but applied more towards like a personal, like brand aesthetic, cultural, like lifestyle sorts of things.
Yeah. Well, it gets more important too, because obviously these networks sort of interpenetrate us more and more. I mean, it's bad enough if there's something wrong with your phone or your laptop, but you know, I think in the next 30 years or so, it's reasonable to expect that at least some part of the population will have, you know, some sort of brain-machine interface.
Yeah, I just hope that we build really good firewalls. Yeah, I mean, once we start talking about these more sensitive operations of, you know, digitizing people or direct neural interfaces, that's when I think it does behoove us to switch, you know, the architectural model, you know, switch to building models that are, you know, robustness first rather than optimizing for other things. I think the most applicable current model for that is it's basically aerospace engineering. You know, you have to think of it in terms of high stakes, high precision, you know, very low tolerance for mistakes type of engineering, because the smallest mistake can result in catastrophe. It's just a different way of engineering things, which is antithetical to what I would call web engineering in general. Mm. You know, web engineering is move fast, iterate fast, break things, learn, try again. And that's great for innovation, but it's terrible for high stakes stuff. It's we've seen a lot of controversy, you know, in the crypto space when new projects come along, and they may take the web engineering tactic and, you know, end up with a lot of explosions and people getting hurt. And sure, you know, you can learn a lot from it and move forward, and you know, hopefully eventually you stop doing that and, you know, people stop blowing themselves up and you can have something more stable. But for the people who get blown up, I'm sure they would have preferred that the opposite engineering approach had been taken, that had been more conservative and on the side of safety first.
Yeah, that's a really interesting and a whole other rabbit hole. And we'll have to have you on another time to talk about your engineering philosophy, because I think that that's fascinating and definitely something that the entire crypto space could benefit from hearing. But I think for our time today, we're coming up a bit past an hour, so might be a good time to wrap. Jameson, thank you so much for coming and chatting with us. You know, personally, it's been great to work with you, and you know, even more wonderful to have you as a friend and a peer in the space. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, Jameson, thanks so much. Talk to you tomorrow.
Yeah, see you back at the grind.
Yeah, I'll see you in group chat in 25 minutes.